It's wonderful to see everybody tonight. Thank you for coming and sharing in our worship together, spending some time together in a study of God's Word. We've been working, started yesterday, talking a little bit about how does 1 Corinthians 13, right? This text that we often think about as the love text, and which is a fair attribute as it relates to that particular passage, but we showed yesterday morning in our Bible class time the importance of understanding why Paul wrote it. And with all the challenges and difficulties that was going on with the church in Corinth and all the divisiveness and strife that was happening there, he told them at the end of chapter 12 in verse 31, if you're reading from King James Version or New King James and a couple other translations, that they were needed to understand a better way, a more excellent way. And then he begins to describe to them what that is. And he talks about how love, what should be the motivator behind their actions and purposes. And he began that description then of what love is and what it isn't in relationship to what God would desire from us. And then we've been trying to take those principles and not just define them, but we've been trying to take those principles out of 1 Corinthians 13 and then make application of them as it relates to our physical families, to our spiritual family, to the various connectivities that we have in life. And so that's been our exercise so far in our studies, and we'll continue to do that this evening. Once you open your Bibles, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, let's look at it one more time, just a piece of it tonight, because I want to talk a little bit tonight about what love isn't, because the Bible here in 1 Corinthians 13 verses 5 through 7 teaches us that love isn't, and then it lists for us what it is not. And here in a moment, I'll even summarize maybe some of those things into one simple thought that we can share together this evening. Verse 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, he says, love, speaking of it, does not behave rudely or unseemly, depending on your translation. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It's not easily provoked. It thinks no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. We'll talk a little bit about more of that tomorrow evening in our studies. But I want you to focus this evening on the idea here that love isn't any of those things that God describes there in that text. And may I suggest to you that selfishness is kind of at the root of all those problems. When he talks about love isn't rude, and he talks about how love doesn't exalt itself, love isn't puffed up, love doesn't think of itself as the center of the universe, and love wants to make sure that we appreciate others and esteem them even better than ourselves, the Bible would share with us in other texts. And I'm convinced that when I see even struggles within families, that selfishness is often the root of those particular problems. When I see issues of adultery and fornication and divorce and financial difficulties and lack of generosity, and just the list goes on and on and on, all of those things have a basis of challenge in selfishness. Somebody decided that what they wanted in a particular moment in time was more important than the relationship. They believed that it was more important than the vows they had made. They had determined that what they wanted instantaneously that was set before them was more important than love. Selfishness finds itself at the very core of the challenges that we really should be trying to avoid. And in fact, self-centered thinking robs us of the very love and leads to anger and jealousies and arrogance and all the things that we really ought to be trying to avoid. Selfishness and self-centeredness often is the promoter of the very things I would hope that if we're trying to demonstrate the love of God in our lives, that we would be trying to avoid all of these things that the writer Paul shares in this text that are contrary to love. I think a little bit about what Jesus said over in Luke chapter 9, because I want us to appreciate that if we want to adopt the character of Jesus, if we want to be legitimate followers of the Savior, if we want to be Christians, right? We often talk about definitions sometimes, right? If I asked you tonight, what's the definition of a Christian? You would probably quickly go, well, that means to be Christ-like, right? We are Christians. We are Christ-like. We are followers, disciples of Jesus. And all of these things that are contrary to love that Paul wrote about there in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, are also against that very core of who Jesus is. Notice Luke chapter 9, verse 23 with me in this text. He said, then he said to them all, If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. You ever thought about what the importance of that aspect of what Jesus commands and demands of us? That he challenges us in this narrative, and he says, if you desire to follow after me, if you want to be a follower of mine, you're going to have to do something. And he said, everyone who chooses to be my follower is going to have to deny self. You and I can't have it any other way. You and I might prefer to give Jesus some and keep some for ourselves. You and I might like to withhold a little bit from Jesus. Give me just a little bit of control of certain things. Let me make some of my own choices, even if they are contrary to what Jesus would want. And we don't love the Savior if that's our mindset. Jesus said those who are his followers, those who commit to him, those who want to be legitimate disciples, those who want to demonstrate love in the right kinds of ways, need to be willing to deny self and take up the cross and challenges of our daily lives and follow Jesus. And so tonight, let's talk about that. How is it that I can begin to avoid this selfishness that seems to deplete love out of all kinds of relationships? How can I build an understanding of these things to the point where maybe I'll learn to not be so self-centered and not think of self before other things and create all kinds of challenges in my relationships? What can we learn about this process of letting love rule rather than selfish ambition? And learning selfless love, let me suggest to you, as a family conversation, needs to start early. You know what the worst word I've ever heard one of my children say? And I'm going to say it out loud so you won't be overly shocked. Mine. Parents, you remember the first time you heard your child say the word mine, right? Those crayons are mine. That book is mine. That Matchbox car is mine. And it was like fingernails on a chalkboard. And now all of a sudden your brain's running and you're trying to figure out who taught them that? And then you realize it was you, and then it becomes even scarier. Right? My point is, friends, if we want our children to love selflessly, we need to teach them early. If we want teenagers that love selflessly, if we want grown-ups that love selflessly, then they need to be understanding that at the earliest of ages possible. And yes, there are going to be moments of education. And yes, a child's going to struggle to understand that principle at times. And you're going to have to come back to it and back to it and back to it and back to it in order for them to help and appreciate that. But I want us to know that I think that's what Jesus would want us to do. He would want us to make sure that we emphasize the importance of understanding that if we're always constantly pushing forward the idea that children always come first, we may be sending a mixed message. In Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 3, read with me something else that Paul taught. Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 3, he said, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition." I love texts like that, right? Because they're nice and easy and simple to understand. He didn't say, let a few things. He didn't qualify it. He just said, nothing. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. You know what you're doing when you're helping a child understand the principle of sharing? You're teaching them what Paul taught in Philippians chapter 2, that people who love one another properly are giving. Those who love one another properly are willing to be sacrificial. Those who love one another properly are willing to esteem others better than themselves. Let each of you, verse 4, look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. It wouldn't take you long to realize I don't shy away from conversation. I don't mind talking. And I could talk to, I try to be able to talk about anything and try to show interest in what other people are interested in. Remember one time when I was in a gospel meeting, we were sitting and having a conversation with some folks about various things, and somebody had mentioned some kind of medical issue, and of course, I've got to chime into the conversation, so I start talking to them about this issue, and I begin to explain to them all the things, all the wisdom that I had, because I'd slept in a Holiday Inn and Suites the night before, and I was perfectly capable, right? I got done just, pontificating over nonsense, and somebody finally saved me by saying, "Dr. Smith?" No idea there was a doctor sitting two seats away from me. "What do you think about that?" "Yeah, I'll be quiet now, right?" "I'll esteem him. I'll esteem him better than me because he can actually help this person. He's actually informed enough to be able to." Hey, what's your point? My point is, friends, sometimes we got to step back. My wife is great about that with me. She'll say, "Brian," all she has to do is say my name in a certain tone, and I know exactly what it means. "You can step back from this, Brian. Be interested in what they want to be interested in." That's what love does. And it's we need to be spending some time with our children and making sure they appreciate that principle early on, that it's not always about them. It can't always be about them. If it's always about them from the time they're zero until the time they're 18, good luck. Good luck. Because now you'll have an adult who believes the entire world centers around them, and then they get into the real world, and it's a real hard awakening. Well, I'm not saying that we don't make sacrifices for children. I think we do. I think there's all kinds of things that we do to help them. We want to make those sacrifices, and we want their lives to be great, and we want to provide them opportunities, and all those things are true and fair. But if we want them to be loving adults someday, if we want them to be considerate of others someday, if we want them to understand the principle of esteeming others and showing that kind of love towards other human beings, then we need to probably start doing that early on in the stages of their life. Help them appreciate early on the idea of selflessness. The writer of Lamentations in Lamentations 3 and verse 27 said it's okay for a young person to learn the idea of work. Now listen, I don't think the writer of Lamentations, the inspired written words of God in Lamentations 3 verse 27, is strap, your four-year-old with a refrigerator and say, "Carry it up those stairs. He's going to learn to work." That's not what he's saying. But find things relevant to their age that they can be responsible for. Find things relevant to their skill set that they can be held accountable for. That's the principle. Children can learn the benefit of responsibility in early stages so that then when it comes time to understand moments where they should be selfless and they should be sacrificial, they've already learned that at home. And you don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to try to learn that when they go to school or when they end up in the workplace sometime. Whatever it might be, you've already instilled in their minds how love is selfless. If we're going to learn this selfless kind of love of 1 Corinthians chapter 13, I'm convinced it's got to start as early as possible so that our children are reared in such a way for them to understand before they ever leave our home. Because if we continue to say children are first, it's always them first. Everything they want, anything they desire, we always put their needs and their interests and everything about them first, then what happened to God in that equation? I've seen a lot of families who make a lot of sacrifices for their children, but the problem is along the way they've also sacrificed what should belong to God in the process. They do some amazing things for their children, but never stop to think that I've also sacrificed what we should be offering unto God in that process as well. In Matthew chapter 10 and verse 37, the words of Jesus, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me." That's powerful. "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." So says Jesus. Friends, I'm not saying it's wrong for us to make our children a priority. I'm not saying that it's sinful for us to want to make sacrifices in order to benefit them and aid them and to help them. I've done that all of my life. But I hope in all of those moments where I've tried to do what I could that was best for my children, that I've never lost sight of the fact that this needs to be in their minds first and foremost. Then in our house, God is always first. I would love to see families start doing that. I've seen them make all kinds of sacrifices for all kinds of other things. And I'd love to see families start saying, you know what? We're going to start making sacrifices that benefit the work of God. We're going to start making sacrifices that fit, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. We're going to start building family relationships, and we're going to start loving the Lord even more than we love anything else that this world has to offer. That's what I need to be instilling in my children and in my family situation, so that they will begin to appreciate what this selfless kind of love that doesn't vaunt itself, that isn't arrogant, that doesn't love iniquity and sinful choices and avoids evil and all those descriptive terms that are found there in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that selfless love that will allow them to avoid all those consequences that the writer Paul spoke of in that text. So let me do this with you. So let's just, for the rest of our time tonight, just talk about some practical ways to choose love over self. How can I do that in real ways? Because I think sometimes we can talk definitions and we never really make practical sense out of it. So let's do that. First thing, show love when you're disappointed. How many times have we gotten disappointed in life and we did everything but love in that moment? And when we desire to be selfish and we feel like that we're the victim in some situation and we decide that we'd rather just kind of break into our own little shell and stay there rather than serving others in the midst of that challenge, I think we miss the kind of love that Jesus demonstrates. Notice with me, John chapter 13. This is the wash the feet chapter, right? This is when Jesus rises up from supper and he begins to wash the feet of his disciples. I've always been amazed that you know who that included? That included Judas Iscariot. The feet of Judas Iscariot were washed right along with every other apostle. I think about that a lot when I read this text. Verse 14, if I then your Lord and Master or teacher have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. Jesus says, I didn't wash your feet for some ceremonial act here. This wasn't just some kind of symbol of how wonderful I am. He said, I did this for you to learn something from. I washed your feet so that you will now go and serve others. And serve others when you're disappointed and discouraged and frustrated with them in the same moment. In Luke chapter 22, we learn that the disciples were arguing. When Jesus rises up from supper, they're fighting. You know what they're fighting about? They're fighting about who's the greatest among them. They've already had the conversations about, Lord, is it I? He had told them, the one who dipped the sop, he's going to be the betrayer. They know that one of them is going to betray him. They're not sure about who that's going to be. They have an argument about whether that they're the worst. And then all of a sudden they begin to argue about who's the greatest. Jesus has to teach them about selfless love. None of you are the greatest. The Gentiles exercise lordship over one another. He had to warn them there in Luke chapter 22. Now John's 13's record, add that to it. He rises up from supper and he washes all their feet, including Judas. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done. I can't help but think that Jesus might have wanted to use, you know, here comes Judas, right? You know, bring me the scalding hot water. Bring me the wire brush. I'm going to scrub Judas's feet. I'm going to make sure he knows. Right? No, he just serves. When you and I are disappointed and you and I are frustrated and you and I believe there's some injustice and we are tempted to act selfishly in those moments, remember that what love does, according to Jesus, is it serves. It finds a way to do an act of kindness. It finds some measure by which we can do something for others. It follows in the example of Jesus' love for His disciples here in John chapter 13. For Most assuredly, he says in verse 16, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy, King James language, some translations use the word, blessed are you if you do them. Friends, you know what brings happiness in life? It's not about serving self, I promise you that. If you are trying to find happiness by serving your own selfish ambitions, I promise you, you will be daily disappointed because you will always find something else better. I'm bad about cars. I could buy a car today. I could bring it home and love everything about it. I could get up the next morning and be ready to trade it. Because there's always something in my mind better. There's something about some other vehicle that would be better than what this one has. And what's the point of that? And by the way, I don't do that. But my point is, if I'm always just about whatever my selfish interests are, if I'm always just about pursuing the things that I'm trying to find value in, then I'm just going to be in this constant pursuit that never happens. Blessed are those who serve others. Happy are you if you serve others. That's what selfless love does. Next time we're having a family squabble, serve. Husbands, the next time you've aggravated your wife, go wash the dishes. Go sweep the floors. Go tend to the children for a couple of hours. Go serve. And you'll add love into the equation. You'll add love into the equation of that relationship. You'll add love into the equation of that home. Go serve. In those moments of disappointment and even where there's arguments, as Jesus was dealing with here in John chapter 13, I believe that's the answer. That's the selfless love answer to those kinds of challenges. When I'm discouraged, don't provoke to anger. When I'm discouraged, provoke to good and promote it. The Hebrew writer wrote this in Hebrews chapter 10. I'm going to talk a little bit about Hebrews, I think, on Wednesday night. But Hebrews chapter 10, just note one thought with me in verse 24. He says, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. Let me ask you just a quick question. Think of the last time you stirred something up. What was it? Was it a hornet's nest? Was it trouble? Was it an argument? Your married couples are good about that, right? It doesn't take you very many years to be married to know how to push each other's buttons. You know exactly what to say and how to say it and when to say it, and you know you're going to get a rise. Why do we do that, right? Why do we do that? Jesus says selfless love when we're discouraged and they've pushed our buttons, so I want to push their buttons, and they've aggravated me, so I want to aggravate them. No. Selfless love says that's the moment where I need to be promoting good. I need to provoke unto love and to good things, not that which is evil. Selfless love wants to promote those kinds of things. When I'm tempted to act selfishly, be accountable. When that bait is sitting there and that allurement of selfish ambition is dangled in front of me, stop and consider the accountability that I have in relationship to that. And accept that accountability. Romans chapter 12, verse 18. I love this text because what this text does is it says, Brian, it's your responsibility. Don't put it on somebody else. In Romans 12, verse 18, he said this. He says, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. You know, sometimes you're trying to diffuse certain circumstances, and people say, well, you don't know what they did. And you know what sometimes I have to say to that? I don't care what they did. Because selfless love does everything possible to live peaceably with everybody. So much as is within me, stop saying, well, they did this, they said that, they responded this way, they created this problem. No, be accountable. That kind of victim mentality even wreaks havoc in marriages and family circles and relationships, where it's always about what somebody else did. I behaved this way because they did or said that. When the Apostle Paul says, no, you do everything humanly possible within your being and within your responsibilities to live peaceably with everybody. If there is a challenge, if there's a squabble, if there's a problem, I'm going to stay above it. Selfless love does that. Selfless love recognizes my own personal accountability when I feel slighted. Don't choose evil. Selfless love doesn't choose evil. When I feel like I've been denied something or been slighted in some way. You want to talk about a family that had struggles. Go back to Genesis chapter 37 with me for a minute. Genesis chapter 37. I just want to note with you here for a moment. A familiar piece of history, right? And here's this moment. Among Jacob and his family. And the issue surrounding Joseph. Verse 4, Genesis chapter 37. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now friends, there's a twofold problem here. Number one problem is dad shouldn't have done that. I was on an airplane one time and they said if the oxygen mask come down, put yours on first and then put one on your child if you have a child with you. And then they said if you have two children with you, pick your favorite. Families do that sometimes. This family did it to such a degree that they put a coat on him to make sure everybody knew who the favorite was. You imagine that? Here these brothers go walking down here or there and doing whatever. And here was Joseph with this coat of many collars on. It was obvious who daddy's favorite was, right? Be careful, parents. Sometimes what we do can be subtle and sometimes not so subtle. And they hated their brother for it. But just because they were in this situation where they feel slighted, just because they feel like their dad had elevated Joseph above the rest, doesn't give them permission to act selfishly. It gets worse. Joseph has a dream and he tells his brothers and they hated him even more. Why? Well, the dream was this, verse 7. They were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? They hated him even more for his dreams and his words. Joseph, you're already wearing a coat that's making these guys pretty angry. I think I'd keep the dreams to myself, right? I think I'd hold off on telling my brothers this dream about how they're going to serve me. Now, you can argue, I suppose, fairly, that he's revealing what God's ultimate purpose is. I get all the historical narrative of that. But I'm just talking about from a family standpoint. Joseph is creating a greater problem. His father has already brought the problem on. Now he's exacerbating it by going to his brothers and keeping telling them these things. But then he has another dream, verse 9. And he tells them that one about how the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to him. And then he tells his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? I don't know whether Jacob's finally kind of getting what he's created here or not. I'm not sure, but he's even concerned about this imagery. What's the point? My point, friends, is the brothers felt slighted. Jacob feels like his own son now was trying to say, well, you're going to have to bow down to me. They all feel slighted, but it doesn't justify the evil that's about to happen. Now, friends, I told you yesterday, I grew up in a household of five. I was the youngest of five, the only boy in the house. I promise you, there were many a day where I felt slighted. And there was probably many a day where my sisters felt slighted because of something I received, but I am thankful they never tried to sell me. But that's what his brothers did. Well, first they thought, let's kill him. And then a couple of them are kind of have a little bit of conscience about them. So, well, no, let's not do that. Let's just sell him. Maybe we don't go to those extremes, but how many times maybe have we? We've felt slighted within a family. We felt like I didn't get invited to that. I didn't get accepted in that circle. I didn't get the advantage, right? Now, I'm not trying to cause trouble for you. I'm just trying to get you to think about it in real ways. Where there are moments in our lives, even in our family circles, maybe even our church family circles, where we feel like we've been slighted. And what I'm trying to get us to encourage and appreciate this evening is selfless love will not return evil for evil. Selfless love, when it maybe even is has been slighted, even when there has been favoritism, even when there have been things that don't really amount to what is right in a circumstance, doesn't justify me to act outside of love. These brothers were wrong. And they better be thankful that Joseph didn't come back evil for evil when they were starving back home and they come to Egypt. And they begin to appreciate maybe what these dreams were actually about. When you and I feel slighted, don't vacate selfless love in the midst of that. When I'm guilty, selfless love does not get defensive. It doesn't lash out towards others. But it embraces the fact that I need to seek forgiveness and penitence and conversion. I think a little bit about Peter here in Luke chapter 22. And I think about the description in verse 32 when Jesus is kind of prepping him for what's going to come. He says in verse 32, "But I have prayed for you." After he warns him that Satan wants to sift him like wheat, he says, "I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." And we know that later Peter will show the kind of penitence necessary. We know that he does ask for forgiveness for what he had done in relationship to Jesus. Friends, when we're guilty, that isn't a time to be selfish. That isn't a time to curl up in defense mode. Those are times to be open and honest and seek the forgiveness that we might need. Love doesn't try to hide or push blame towards somebody else. That's happened so many times, right? When people have been caught in their own guilt. When God comes down in the very beginning, the very first sin that was ever committed. Adam is sitting there. God says, "What'd you do, Adam?" What's Adam's first response? "That woman you gave me." Where's all the selfless love? Where's the leave and cleave, right, Adam? Where's the responsible man? Where's that? Instead of trying to push it off onto the side, I love Peter's attitude that we eventually learn about. In fact, he's very moved by it all. When he realizes that he's guilty of exactly what Jesus warned him about, he goes out and weeps bitterly. And then he comes back and he recognizes that conversion. Friends, when we're guilty, then the act of love is to seek forgiveness. To not try to push aside or to act and behave without love in that moment. I'll add this thought to that. When I caused the problem, be honest about it. You know, too many times you think about, think about marriages, and I think about married couples, and something needs to be forgiven, something needs to be repented of, something needs to apologize for. And rather than accept accountability and be honest about it, what we do is we say, I know I did this, but 32 years ago, you broke my favorite fishing pole. That's not love. I want you to notice this account in Genesis chapter 16. Gave you an extra second to get back there. We referenced this last night. We talked about the children in relationship to this, but go back to Sarah and Abraham's example here. Now Sarah, or Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Now, again, culturally, we don't understand this, right? This doesn't compute to us. But it computed in their mindset. It was something that culturally, then societally, they had embraced this concept of offering servants to bear children. Even though the promises had been made to Abraham and Sarah, she gets impatient. Then Sarah, Abram's wife, verse 3, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram, to his wife, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived. Now, side point, by the way, Abram, you might want to say, well, how awful Sarah is for even thinking this way. He could have pushed the brakes on this idea too, by the way. He could have said to her, "Sarah, no, God's made us a promise. We're committed to it. By faith, it's going to happen. We're going to live by that commitment." And he could have stopped this process, but he doesn't. And when she saw that, her mistress became displeased in her eyes. Then Sarah said to Abram, "My wrong be upon you." Well, wait a minute. I didn't ask you to give me Hagar. You came to me, right? She said, "I gave you my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me." It's an interesting statement, right? The Lord decide which one of us is more culpable here. What's your point? My point is, when I caused the problem, just be honest about it. Don't say, "Well, I didn't realize that I was going to become hated in her eyes. I didn't realize that," and the language here seems to almost imply that Sarah kind of thinks that Abram almost favors Hagar now over her. And then Abraham has to step up and say, "Listen, no, do whatever you want." He gives her Hagar and Ishmael, do whatever. So many times we act outside of love because what we're unwilling to do is be honest and sincere in our love for one another. Just tell the truth. Love does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. And sometimes truth is painful. And sometimes truth is hard to deal with in the moment. And sometimes truth is not easy to overcome. But love demands that we be honest with each other and speak the truth. Only then can real problems be overcome. Only then can we demonstrate the kind of love that God would have for us. Be honest. One fellow said, "Denial ain't just a river in Egypt." I'll give you a second. Right? Denial. Always about somebody else. Oh, that's not love. And we've got to be very careful in our relationships that when I've caused the problem, when it's me, I need to ask. And let me add this, and I almost forgot to, but there have been many a times where I've had to sit my children down and say, "Dad did the wrong thing right there." There have been times where I've had to sit my children down and say, "I overreacted to that circumstance. I disciplined you and I shouldn't have. I was upset about this or that and I took it out on you, and that's not right." There have been many a time, and friends, that is not a sign of weakness. I know a lot of men who would believe it is. It is not. It's a sign of love. It's a sign of selfless love. that recognizes my own failure sometimes, and I need to be honest about it. And I need to speak the truth. There are times when I fussed at Deborah, and it wasn't anything about Deborah. It was about me. It was about something that I wasn't handling right, and it was something that I wasn't dealing with in the right ways, and she took the brunt of it. That's dishonest. That's rejoicing in iniquity. That's vaunting myself and puffing myself. That's the opposite of the love that God would describe for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. So when I'm hurting, when I've been disappointed, when I'm discouraged, when everything in life is leading me to act and behave without love, when it's leading me to behave selfishly instead of selflessly, when I'm continually bombarded with things and temptations that are trying to persuade me to act and behave in ways that I know God would not honor and that don't fit the description of love that God has provided, I leave you with this tonight. Don't let Satan win. Ephesians 4, verse 26. Be angry and do not sin. All of us maybe would prefer that if he had just left the first two words in place, right? Be angry. I just got permission. No. Be angry and sin not. But here, let's appreciate this for quickly. There are some things that produce a righteous indignation, right? There are things and behaviors and choices that result in anger, disappointment, frustration. But he says, be angry, but don't sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. One of the worst phrases I ever heard when I was growing up was, wait till your dad gets home. Because I knew, apparently, my behaviors had reached a point where my mom's discipline was not quite sufficient, and dad was bringing it. And I dreaded it. The rest of the day, waiting. But do you know how ineffective that would be? Do you know how ineffective that would be if 6 days later he walks in and says, oh, by the way, I hear that 6 days ago, if you ever told your children in a car, if you don't settle down, I'm pulling this car over, and you never pulled it over. I said that a few times to my children. They started calling me out on it. One time out on Route 7 going between Moundsville and well, across the bridge, but going down Route 7, somebody, I said it. I said, one more time, and I'm pulling this car over. And they kind of chuckled and thought, no, he isn't. We said that a billion times. He's never done it. And they did it, and the dirt was flying. Because I finally realized I'd been lying to him. Been lying to him. The moment came, and the moment needed to be dealt with. Because if I let it go, and let the sun, I just let that all fester, and then I'm just going to explode in some awful way. Verse 27, nor give place to the devil. Love overcomes Satan every time. Why? Because God is love, and God always wins. Always. So when you and I adopt the love that is God into our lives, when we live that selfless love of 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and we interject that into every relationship, whether it be our marriages, whether it be our parenting, whether it be our in-law relationships that we spoke about yesterday, whether it be our friendships, whether it be our coworkers, it doesn't matter to me. You can apply it in any circumstance. Selfless love wins. And it certainly keeps me from giving way to Satan. we give him too much already. Satan doesn't deserve your heart and your focus. He doesn't deserve it. And so I challenge all of us tonight. When we're tempted to act in anger, when we're tempted to act outside of truth, when we're tempted to act dishonestly, remember selfless love to overcome those challenges that we often face. This evening, if you're subject to the gospel in some way, what greater selfless love could we talk about than Jesus' willingness to give himself upon a cross, to experience the death of the cross, to bring hope and salvation and remission of sins to us? What greater act of selfless love could we ever speak of? If you appreciate the love that Jesus has experienced for us and demonstrated to us, and you're ready to step into that remission of sins, to have your sins washed away in baptism, to appreciate that newness of life and that resurrection that comes as we die to sin. Or maybe you need to step back into a loving relationship with the Savior, to be honest about the failures and confess those things and acknowledge them and turn from them. How can we help you? How can we strengthen you in your service to God even this hour? And if there's something we could encourage you in, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?